You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Good morning, and welcome to Brookings. Thanks for joining us so early in the morning. I am Martin Indyk, the Executive Vice President of the Brookings Institution. It's my pleasure to welcome you all today to this program on moving to access and the initiative we're undertaking here at Brookings in that regard. I'm particularly grateful to Secretary Mendez, from Secretary of Transportation from Buenos Aires, and Secretary Pollock, Secretary of Transportation and CEO of the Department of Transportation from Massachusetts, for joining us this morning. Later on in the day, we'll have the pleasure of hosting Secretary Fox, the Secretary of Transportation of the United States. The Moving to Access initiative aims to inform and promote a more socially focused, access-first approach to urban transportation policy, planning, investment, and services. I want to talk first a little bit about how we at Brookings are executing this project, because it is a flagship effort in terms of the approach that we are trying to promote in Brookings' second century, which officially begins this month, in which we are seeking to promote collaboration across our different research programs. Few of you will be aware that we have 106 full-time scholars at Brookings that cover every imaginable issue of policy, starting, of course, with urban policy, but going all the way across to global economic development and foreign policy. Research programs have tended to develop as stovepipes, as all large organizations tend to do. And so as part of our second century initiatives, we are seeking to promote collaboration across our research programs. And I'm delighted that the Metropolitan Policy Program, led by Amy Liu, is coming together with our Global Economy and Development Program, led by Kamal Dervis, to promote this cross-program initiative on moving to access. This is, from our perspective, the way to promote the best of Brookings, combining unique scholarly specialties in both urban and global development issues. And this is, I think, unique, a collaboration which I hope you will see in action today and the benefits it can bring. This initiative also brings together two of our common challenges, urbanization and growth and opportunity. We identified five big bets that our scholars would focus on over the next coming years, and urbanization and growth and opportunity were two of them. And this kind of multidisciplinary work is important to developing and advancing understanding about policy issues in our hyper-connected world. As you'll hear throughout this morning's events, cities and metropolitan areas all across the world understand the challenges that come from trying to get their residents to where they need to go on a daily basis. This can't just be a playground for the rich. We need our built environment to work for all people, regardless of income, race, or local geography. So you'll be hearing from a panel of experts, many of whom are actively working in different parts of the world, but facing these same challenges every day. To introduce the Moving to Access initiative, I want to introduce you to Adi Tome. Adi Tome is one of our rising star scholars, a fellow in our Metropolitan Policy Program, where he serves as the co-director of this initiative. So, Adi, thank you for your work in this regard, and please come and explain to us what it's all about.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Martin, for that really kind introduction. And I want to thank everyone for taking the time to make it down here today to the Brookings Institution. It's a really, really busy week here in Washington. I think anyone who loads a newspaper from any geography is hearing about what's happening further down Massachusetts Avenue, or you could say Pennsylvania Avenue, too, for hearings on Capitol Hill. But for many of us in the transportation industry, it's actually a busy week that we knew was coming anyways, because it's the Transportation Research Board meetings. And for those of you who may not be in the know, this is why whenever you've traveled around Mount Vernon Square for the past week or so, you see a ridiculously long line of taxis, and it's busier than normal when you try to travel through that little underpass on L Street. In a town that is really built around hosting conventions, this is actually pretty much one of the biggest, if not the biggest, we have all year. And what it is actually the single biggest global convention, if you want to use that word, of transportation professionals from a huge range of disciplines. And that, by bringing those people together, what you see is a huge array of different topics that people are covering. In one room, you can find chemical engineers talking about pavement quality and how to make sure that porousness, well, you know what, I'm not going to keep talking about it because I'm not a chemical engineer and I really don't understand what they're talking about. Second, in another room, you can find lawyers talking about tort reform. Or in the case of how our financing models are being built up, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, most likely talking about what are the legal dimensions to public-private partnerships. In a totally different room, you can find urban planners talking about the future economies of the places where we all live. Now, there is one thing, though, that brings these people together, and that's actually just people, right? So when it comes to what we do on a daily basis, so much of our daily activities take place outside the home, from students studying in school to workers cramming into their offices or the factory floors, to households shopping for their daily needs, to residents just finding time for a little bit of exercise. So many things that we do, again, take place outside the home. And so if we want to accomplish our personal daily goals, then we need to get moving. And to make all of this uncoordinated ballet possible, we need transportation networks that connect people to opportunity. Now, this requires a mix of transportation modes. It depends on the geography of place of where you live and where you're trying to go, the distances traveled, the time that you have available to do all of those daily activities. And we also need those systems to be equitable, right? We need those systems to work for all people and make sure they can all get where they need to go, irrespective of income or skin color. Yet while every year we see new roads and transit lines built, new housing structures take shape, we need to ask ourselves really important questions. Are we building communities that work for all people? I want you to take a second and think about your hometown, or for most of us, especially those of us who live in Washington, our adopted hometowns. When you think about all the neighborhoods where you live, do they all connect people to opportunity? Do they all move? Can people always move as easily in each of those places? Are we building those communities with the right purpose? And do our systems reflect the kind of broader objectives we want to achieve? Our Moving to Access initiative is an applied research project to attempt to answer those very questions. Along with my co-director, Jeff Gutman, a senior fellow in the Brookings Global Economy and Development Program, our absolutely tireless staff here at Brookings, and a truly impressive network of co-authors and advisors, this project represents our efforts to put people at the center of how we design, deliver, govern, and finance urban transportation. Now, doing so isn't going to be easy, And as we're going to discuss throughout the day, or at least this morning, there are significant path dependencies that stand in our way. Current investment models unintentionally favor the wealthy and outright favor the automobile in most cases. Too often, cities and regions get built without broader objectives in mind. And the various disciplines that all have a hand in how we plan and build our communities too often prefer to operate in silos rather than coordinate up, down, and across agency divisions. But the opportunities here couldn't be greater to tilt those paths. So today, I want to talk about our project and the concept of accessibility in three phases. First, we need to take the time to better understand exactly how we're physically building communities today. What does that look like on the ground? What's guiding those decisions? And what are some of the obvious blocks to our path forward? Second, the concept of accessibility offers a new way forward, but that path won't be easy, and there are many blocks in addition, just if we try to go along that path. And then finally, I'll conclude with what we all can do, not just this team and this initiative, to advance this theory into practice a bit more. But let's go back to where we stand today. So last time I actually spoke up here, which is a few months back, I made a confession. So I'm now going to make another confession. I don't know why I treat this a little bit like my religious house, speaking on the stage. I'm a Floridian. And sometimes that's actually really embarrassing to say to people. You can make up all the tropes in your mind. If you don't follow Florida Man on Twitter, it's a really important part of the internet in a corner to learn about really funny stories. And I'm not just saying that. Really, you should follow Florida Man on Twitter. But actually, to be honest, when I think about why I'm a bit embarrassed to be a Floridian is I didn't really like the community that I grew up in. We always felt like we were stuck in cars. It took forever to get everywhere. And in many ways, that's because Florida is a symbol of what it's like to develop in an era where there's air conditioning, first of all, at least for us. But more importantly, the automobile was here, and we could build communities around it. I want you to make sure for the next few slides that you put your eyes a little bit on the upper right corner at first to see what we're talking about. Obviously, we're talking about Miami here, not my corner of Florida, but certainly our global symbol, and the year below it. And we'll often be starting in the 1980s. I think what you can find is that we've often developed our communities very fast in an outward manner. In the case of Miami, we've encroached upon our most valuable natural treasure, the Everglades. And you can see super blocks that only filled up with time. But here's the thing. We oftentimes, especially in the United States, think our development patterns are unique to us, but they're not. This is the Desert Palace, known as Dubai. And you can see outward growth dramatically into the desert. New land taken up, new opportunities to move around, and of course, in the case of Dubai, new land created from scratch. Now, let's take this onto an actual supersized level. This is Bangkok, one of the world's truly great megacities. You can actually see Bangkok in the east start to eat up all of the land in its little corner of Thailand. Now, that's a dramatic change in development patterns from what was there before. And again, I want a case in point. This was already a megacity in 1984, effectively. And all it's doing is gobbling up more land. Now, it's not just the biggest cities of the world where names you already know. Whether it's Cairo to the forests of Alberta, we are constantly eating up land to put more people in more places for a whole range of reasons, from wanting more space to oftentimes wanting to stretch out distances between where we live. Now, I think what we really are seeing at play is the visualization of the current model we use to help people get around our cities. Too often, we are focused exclusively on moving vehicles quickly. We're too much focused, including inside our investment in engineering models, on solving congestion above everything else. And meanwhile, we've overlooked some of the unintended consequences from what this model means on the ground. So you saw it in play in seven communities across the world, but again, you could put almost any of those stunning growth images on the screen and you would see similar development patterns. So most notably, for many of us that work in the urban economic and policy analysis fields, it's creating what we know as spatial mismatch. Now, that's kind of a fancy way of just saying something that you experience in your daily life, which it feels like, and it in fact is in place, that the distances between where people live and where they want to go are growing longer. So the question is, what have been our responses as households and how we choose to live our lives? Well, number one is people are addicted to cars. And in many ways, they're not to blame, right? How else could you get around? So you'll see on the left portion of the chart, more developed economies, and you're seeing car ownership rates at the household level that are almost near ubiquity. But look further to the right for some of the countries you may not expect, where vehicle ownership rates are similarly high, including around 50% in many of the largest Latin American countries. Now, you may say this isn't surprising, but these are places with lower household per capita incomes that are choosing to dedicate most higher values than you might expect to vehicle ownership. But here's the thing. Personal motorized transportation comes in two forms. And in many of those same countries where you see lower car ownership rates, in fact, motorbike rates are increasingly high. So think back to that picture of Bangkok. So many of those residents are choosing to get around by motorbike. And while it may take up less engineering space on the road, it similarly requires fuel consumption and also exacerbates those kind of distances, unlocking for at least an individual more further distances that they can go, but only stretches our communities out further and further. Now, at the same time as all those vehicles are being owned, you can imagine that it ends up leading to higher household expenses. Now, it's really hard to find international comparisons on these numbers, but many folks are surprised to hear about just how much we're all spending just to get around. In many countries, you actually spend more on transportation than you do on food. Now, of course, vehicles are only contributing at the same time to a dirtier planet. By one measure, from 2014, the transportation sector now represents 23% of all carbon emissions. And while other sectors, like energy production and an industry and building stock, are getting more efficient, transportation is actually getting dirtier. And you can see that if by 2050, we don't solve our emissions problems that relate to all that driving and all those long distances, it will be impossible to mitigate the negative effects of climate change. Now, finally, here's the other issue, but also something that we can use as a pivot. We need to invest more in infrastructure. Based on a major McKinsey report, they estimate that on just transportation infrastructure alone, we need to invest globally $1.3 trillion in new infrastructure. Now, this includes new capacity. It also includes maintenance. And this raises a big question. Where is this investment going to happen? Well, I want to push you to look at the same chart that we've reproduced here from them. But if you put up a chart that similarly looked at population growth rates, it would look really similar. Because, in fact, it's in the emerging parts of the world where population growth is fastest that we're going to need to make the biggest investments in transportation infrastructure. Now, folks can quibble with these numbers and exactly how big they should be, but here's what I want you to focus on for the rest of this conversation today. It's the question of, what are we going to build? Are we going to build the transportation and other related investments that led to those animated maps that you saw before? Or are we going to build something different, even recognizing the transformative industrial power we have along our transportation networks, but still get more efficient in how people choose to get around and what they can reach? So that leads to the second part of the conversation. How can we plan around accessibility? So let's be honest, though, and I really do appreciate all of you coming here, but how many of you knew what the term accessibility was before you walked in the room? That is so many more hands than I was expecting to see, and I was kind of hoping you wouldn't raise them. But for those of you who maybe are streaming or those of you who just don't know, it's a term of art that's kind of difficult to fully understand, right? So first and foremost, in the transportation sector, we already use the word for something else, right? Now, what do we mean about access in this concept? So whether it's a regional highway network or a local sidewalk, the goal of our systems, as Martin said in the introduction, is to get people where we need to go. An accessibility approach to transportation captures this overarching pursuit. When academics and practitioners use the term accessibility, and this is the key kind of exact definition, they're referencing how many value destinations, whether it's jobs, schools, parks, shopping, individuals can reach in a given period of time. In a way, access reflects how each one of us thinks about travel on a daily basis. When you plan your commute to work, are you going to have time to stop by the dry cleaner? How about at the end of the day? Who's going to have time to pick up the kids? And based on that combination of time, and especially for those of us in our largest metropolitan areas across the world, it leads to the choices of what transportation modes we're going to take, right? Do we have to drive today because it feels like time's so tight, there's no options, and we feel confident we can find parking where we're going to go? Is time better, and you want to get a quick walk-in, so you're going to take your local bus or rail network? That's what accessibility is really all about. Now, these decisions truly define our day, but they do more than just define our day. They actually define our more permanent choices, too. Think about where you choose to live and all the mapping you did, or to determine the best neighborhood for you, and of course, probably your household budget as well. But then also think about when you're looking for a new job. Don't you look at where that zip code is of that employer? How long is it going to take to get to work? Access is part of how you think about life. And what truly separates accessibility from other applied theories in transportation is that its inherent multidisciplinarity. Accessibility requires a recognition of how different policy disciplines and their respective actors, inside and outside government, all have a role to play when it comes to connecting people to opportunity. So on the transportation side, access doesn't discriminate based on a particular transportation mode, nor does it look solely at isolated transportation corridors. Access also recognizes how much land use patterns affect how far people need to travel. And one of the most important aspects for Jeff and I as we move on this initiative is that it also needs to consider pricing. It can't just be transportation and land use, because both in terms of time taken and money spent, connecting people and places is not free. All these components interact in an urban mixing bowl that defines the places that we live, but also reflects long-term planning decisions. So I want to take a second and put this in a real-world example for a moment, not just the development maps we saw, but how access can actually change what we do. So this is Liverpool, England, and this is the original and continued site, as I'm giving away the story a little bit, of the Royal Liverpool Hospital. Now, Liverpool was considering moving their hospital. It's a conversation you've probably heard in so many different communities that you live in. So here was the site of the new hospital. Doesn't seem that far, although this scale is actually fairly large for a local urban area. Now, here's the catch. If we think about things in an accessibility way, so this is a heat map, by moving to the new location, those who lived around the new hospital would be able to get there easier. The parts that you see in the red and yellow would have actually lost access to vital healthcare services. Now, not only can you see that heat map that's yellow and red is bigger, here's the other way to note it. So many of those people who live in those yellow and red areas, they're transit-dependent populations. They were going to move the hospital further away from where the people who needed it most lived. Now, here's the other part of the issue. The proposed hospital was going to be cheaper to build, but the net costs on society were going to be higher. And because the United Kingdom at the time had accessibility practices on the books, you know what they did? They rebuilt the Royal Liverpool Hospital in the original location. It was better for the economy, even if it looked a little bit worse on their accounting books. Now, in the case of this Liverpool healthcare story, a better decision was made. But in most parts of the world, access isn't a formal part of the planning process. In fact, accessibility has long been a popular theory among academics, but we haven't seen it in practice. So this raises a major question. What stopped it from being adopted? So today, we are really excited to release a set of four papers that kind of get this conversation started for a more practitioner audience to define accessibility from three different perspectives in particular. Christo Venter, who's in town to join us for TRB today and in conferences later in the week, authored a paper from the transportation perspective. Gilles de Ranton and his co-author Eric Guerra, and you will hear from Gilles and the panel to follow this conversation, talked about it from an urban planning perspective. And third, Shahid Youssef talked about it from a fiscal and finance perspective. Jeff Gutman and I then synthesized these documents, and there's, I think a pun intended here, the most accessible way we could, and a short 10-page document for those of you who maybe didn't raise your hands about what does access mean and what are some of the common challenges that are blocking it if it's an idea that makes sense from moving into practice. And what these authors found and what Jeff and I's own work and our teams found is that there's four common themes that seem to separate and block accessibility theory from moving into practice. So number one is there's extreme lack of conceptual clarity here. Start with just the definition. It already has an alternative meaning within transportation, and even for those who know it, they can struggle with imagining what it looks like in practice. There's measurement issues. Christo talks about the wide range of different measurement types that you can use to put accessibility into practice, all of which are valid depending on the goals that you're trying to achieve. Similarly, it's expensive. You need new data, you need new software, and we'll have another paper just on that in the next 2 months coming out about how governments can move forward on putting accessibility data and software into play. Finally, there's no gold standard for what accessibility measures. How do we compare different neighborhoods? How do we compare different markets? And you might hear the panel after this talk about that a little bit from their different perspectives. Next, we have something known as legacy issues. And I highly recommend if this part resonates with you to check Gilles' paper. What we've built in the past is often permanent. It's near impossible to up and replace. For those of you who live in Washington, D.C., think about the expenses we're spending out in Tyson's Corner right now to try to remake a major neighborhood and regional job center. It also reflects, though, these past efforts, the economic ideals of the day. A downtown rail corridor looks a lot different than a suburban area. Even in the picture you're seeing on the right is Melbourne, Australia, known as the most livable city in the world. It's also the interaction between them that matters. Different areas of construction collide together on a daily basis in different ways. Third, who is going to pay for all this stuff? Too often in urban development planning, we overlook major questions about who would pay and who should pay. How can we share subsidies? How can we think about what services you pay for relative to the value that you get from the places either that you're living in or the property that you own? All of this needs to move in to a major bowl of decision-making to come together to make better investments in the future. And of course, our governance frameworks are not necessarily evolved enough to advance an accessibility platform. Accessibility requires real coordination. We are so excited to have three different government officials here with us throughout this program today. You're going to hear about how tough coordination is. And yet, as it stands, agencies operate formally in silos. And oftentimes, even worse, they prefer it that way. How can we break through? So moving forward is obviously not going to be easy. But we're passionate about trying to advance that ball. And there's many efforts outside of Brookings that are, of course, already underway. Our colleagues at the University of Minnesota put out just some recent research last week, building on a real legacy of work both there, here at Brookings, and throughout the academic literature about measures to understand what does accessibility look like in your community. In the case of University of Minnesota, the 50 biggest markets in the United States, I highly recommend you check out that research online. Again, the same pun, it's very accessible. The UN Sustainable Development Goals are thinking about new ways to implement ideas about how we get around and who pays. And in the case of Bogota, but you could also say Lima, they're playing with new ideas around subsidies on how we can connect people to opportunity, in the case of Bogota, through their public transportation system. Now, our future work, we're pledging to do the following. Number one is we're going to keep advancing empirical work. There is so much more to understand about what are the actual economic benefits from accessibility. That research, which has been done in the past, needs to be communicated out to more people. We can advance thinking around measurement. We can test new ideas in cities and regions that are willing to experiment. We outline so much of this potential work in the overview document that we published today. But here's really the thought I want to leave you with, is that laundry list of work that needs to be done, it's much more than Jeff and I could ever get to on our own. So for those of you who are in the research community or work inside government, take a second to read that paper and look at the ideas for future work. There are so many opportunities to advance the literature here and to make sure that we better understand how to build communities for the future. We have a really exciting program for you for the rest of the day. building on the messages from President Obama's speech last night, one that included an explicit focus on how we can help people reach better opportunity, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox will be here to have a conversation with our VP, Amy Liu, about the work he's championed in office around this very topic. But before we get to Secretary Fox and Amy, we have a panel that's going to explore more of the themes I've introduced today. I'll now turn the stage over to Kathy Sierra, a non-resident senior fellow here with the Brookings Institution and our moderator of the panel. We're all in extremely capable hands. So thank you, and Kathy, the stage is yours.
Thank you very much. Adi, thank you so much for that presentation. Reminded me of my work in the 90s. I was in charge of urban development and transportation for the World Bank, working on China. And we basically, in our group, put in place the second and third ring roads in Beijing and in Shanghai. And I remember at the time thinking, I don't think this is the right thing to do. It was the momentum was just there. This is what the Chinese government wanted. There was clearly what seemed to be the state of the art at the time, but we didn't have the kind of conversations that we could build on, but we knew that we needed to have these conversations. So I think we've maybe a little bit too late for some of the legacies that were built at the time when I was working in transportation, but certainly not too late for some of the challenges that we have today. So I'm really excited to introduce this panel, because we have on the panel people that are today worrying about these issues, worrying about how to build strong transportation systems that not only bring together mobility for people, but also access to opportunity to the social dimensions, but seeing some of the barriers to that. So what we want to do is explore those barriers, see what's actually happened in real life, and see what the recommendations are going forward. On the panel today, we have Secretary of Transportation of Buenos Aires, Juan Jose Mendez. Secretary Mendez brings 5 or 6 years of experience in the public sector. Before that, he was an entrepreneur and a consultant working on these issues. He and his team put together a sustainable mobility program in Buenos Aires, which won accolades, and has been able to, and will be sharing with us some real-world experiences of some of the triumphs, but also some of the concerns that he brings to the table. We also have Secretary Pollack, who's the Secretary and CEO of the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. She brings to us a very deep knowledge of policy issues as a researcher, as a strategic consultant, before moving into government. Again, we'll bring to the conversation both what she knows about what's happening in the world of research, of the world of practitioners, but also what is actually happening in the world of politics in a city, in this state, which faces many of the same legacy issues that Adi spoke about. And then finally, we have Professor Gilles Durantan with the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the director of the real estate department, the chair of real estate there, who brings to the conversation research on land issues, and will particularly focus on how those bring to bear on the issues of transportation, but also a lot to talk to about silos and about governance issues as we go forward. So with that, I think we're all mic'd, correct? So, and I have a cold, so excuse me for that. I want to, and I hope I'm not giving it to you, I'm going to start with Secretary Mendez. We heard a very compelling presentation about how the world needs to shift towards accessibility. You've been trying to do this in Buenos Aires. Can you give us some sense of what the goals have been in Buenos Aires? What have been some of the successes, but in particular, what have been some of the challenges and barriers to it?
Well, I don't know how many of you are familiarized with the city of Buenos Aires. The city is part of a metropolitan area of 14.5 million inhabitants with 2,500 square meters of kilometers of area. And these 22 million trips per day were historically based on mass transit mainly. The city has a long-standing tradition of mass transit, commuter rails with over 850 kilometers network, bus routes, over 200 bus routes with 18,000 buses running all around the metropolitan area, subway network, not very very big, but with 65 kilometers and over 1.2 million riders per day. But in the past 30 years, what we've seen in the city of Buenos Aires, in the metropolitan area, was the, first of all, there was no coordination at all between the different government levels, the federal government, the Buenos Aires city government, the Buenos Aires state government, and the 42 municipalities, member of this metropolitan area. They weren't coordinating any kind of effort. In the past 8 years, when we start running the city of Buenos Aires with Mayor Macri, which is nowadays the president of Argentina, and now with Mayor Larreta, which is from the same party, we accepted the challenge with the vision to keep or to increase again the service level of mass transit in the city of Buenos Aires, because we've been seeing how the mass transit was losing passengers for car riders, and how the car use in the city of Buenos Aires was increasing year after year. So our first challenge was to stop that and to start changing that that trends again. Hopefully we were very successful doing that in the city of Buenos Aires, in our space of governance, these 200 square kilometers we governance, which is the city center of the metropolitan area. But we still miss the interjurisdictional coordination. We couldn't achieve any type of coordination with the federal government. It was just very recently that we could set up a metropolitan transport agency that institutionally was created 4 years ago, but it was December 2015 when Mayor Macri started his presidency with the goal to strengthen and create metropolitan agencies. We started a new period with the metropolitan agency, and for the first time, we started coordinating basic things as, for example, mass transit fares. We introduced also to acknowledging that one of the biggest challenges in the city of Buenos Aires are low-income communities. We introduced the social fare, which is a specially discounted fare for low-income population. And right now we are all in the coming month, we are launching the intermodal fare, which is also going to help low-income communities. So when we talk about access, what we see is that we have a huge transportation network that it used to be very disconnected. It was not integrated in any way physically, nor in terms of fares. And many of our citizens and neighbors in the metropolitan area were taking a very, very inefficient decisions when they trying to reach their destinations, whatever their reason. And what we are trying to do, and our biggest challenge right now, is to make those decisions more efficient, to allow them. I'm going to draw it with a quick example. We have some people in the metropolitan area that every day they choose using one bus route that takes you from home to work, and it takes them 1 hour or 70 minutes every day for each trip in this one bus they took every day. Probably, or in many cases, they have other opportunities, like using a bus for a short trip and then a train trip that it will take them to their destination in half of the time or maybe 45 minutes, which it looks more efficient, but they don't do it because they have to pay two fares. Every time they jump from one mode to the other, they pair an additional fare. And usually people that lives farther away, they are the lower income communities. And it's even, so we are inducing them to very inefficient decisions in terms of mobility and wasting more time because they are not allowed to spend more money. So this is the type of behavior we want to change with this coordination between these three different government levels.
Thank you. So what I hear is using the legacy systems, trying to integrate them, but also using as an important lever pricing,
yes,
both in terms of subsidies as well as just cleaning up some of the anomalies to be able to provide poor people access to opportunity.
Yes.
Let me move to Secretary Pollack. We had a conversation before this, you gave me some skepticism about whether what you had written about and others in this room and other had written about in terms of accessibility as being a major driver for the future and what the reality is in the state of Massachusetts. Can you compare and contrast really what the conversation we're having today with what you find on the ground in Massachusetts?
So I think that in academia, which is where I was until 2 years ago when I became secretary, it is widely accepted that accessibility is a better framework for thinking about the role of transportation in achieving objectives. But transportation agencies are mobility agencies. And they don't wake up every morning and say, I'm a mobility agency, but that's what they're set up to do. So there are at least four reasons why it will be difficult to get transportation agencies to reinvent themselves in the way that this this conversation sort of presupposes needs to happen. The first I would categorize as culture. Quite frankly, transportation agencies know surprisingly little about the people and places that they serve. You don't need to in order to do the work that we are asked to do. To really be, to live in an accessibility-centric world, you actually have to know, you know, think about Adi's presentation, where people live, where people work, where they get their health care. Most transportation agencies don't know that. And honestly, some people, and I'm not just talking about the folks who work for me, have startlingly little interest in that piece of information, or startlingly little access to that piece of information. So there's a sort of a culture change that you are presupposing that people who came to an agency to do one thing are going to suddenly get interested in a second thing. The second issue you have is what is referred to in the papers as governance. I would call it a span of control issue. If you're serious about accessibility, then the question you ask changes, right? The question is not how to move people. The question is how to support people in gaining access to opportunity. I don't control where the hospital goes in Liverpool. I don't control where affordable housing gets built. I don't control the hours of operation that companies or community colleges or job training programs choose to start earlier in the morning or end later at night than the transit services that my agencies provide. So there's a serious question about whether if you are serious about accessibility, the transportation department is actually the right part of government to start with. The third thing I would mention briefly is the issue of tools. Transportation agencies do two things, right? They operate, they provide service to customers, and they invest. They figure out which things to build or fix. There are a very limited range of tools that help understand accessibility for both of those things, although I'm happy to talk about examples where folks are starting to use accessibility tools and metrics in both of those areas. But the fundamental tool around which most U.S., not just transportation agencies, but our key planning transportation agencies, which are called metropolitan planning organizations, are built are regional travel models. And just to maybe help you understand how deeply that tool is a mobility tool and not an accessibility tool is to think of it this way. In a regional travel model, the output of the tool, the social utility of the thing you are planning for, right, is actually travel. It spits out numbers in trips and miles and movements, right? The inputs to those models are everything that we care about in this room. The inputs are land use and jobs and housing and healthcare and recreational opportunities. If you're serious about accessibility, right, we have to invert that. the output of the tools we use actually needs to be information about access and where healthcare and jobs and housing are or should be in the future. And the input, transportation, is just an input. So the tool issue is a big issue, and that leads to another issue which the papers do talk about, which is we live, my compatriots in the other 49 states in the District of Columbia, since the second to last major federal transportation bill, live in a world driven by performance measurement. That is what the federal government expects us to do. We have to report to them about how we are going to reduce the number, the percentage of our bridge decks that are structurally deficient and improve the condition of our pavement on the interstate highways. If there is no metric, there is no way for me to direct resources to things that is easy. Yet the papers themselves concede that it's not clear. It's clear that there isn't a great singular accessibility metric, and there may never be. So if you want performance-driven, data-driven agencies to change what they do, you have to give them a measurable target to aim toward. And we don't have that for accessibility.
So I think you correctly say this is, you've got a major culture barrier. And maybe a governance barrier because of what our departments of transportation actually set up to do. So that leads me to the question, is where should the leadership come from? Is it the mayors? Is it a vision that comes at the state level? Are you seeing at least a demand for that culture change and a demand to opening up the conversation beyond the Department of Transportation in the state of Massachusetts?
So I think there's a couple of issues, right? The demand, I believe, will come from outside the agencies, right? The demand will come from advocates for people to make sure that their needs are met. And there is a question about where that demand should be aimed, right? So a big one is the city level, the metropolitan level, the state level. Those are very different. Mayors, quite frankly, have a lot more tools at their disposal because they have more of a role in the education system, the healthcare system, the land use system, at least in my state, but I think in many U.S. states, than governors do. So I think that is an issue, is sort of how much of the effort. I also, though, think for there to be a conversation that leads to a set of demands that in turn leads to change, we have to find a way to have the conversation because, as I said, when I lived in academia and spent my time talking to other academics and went to conferences, it was easy to talk about accessibility. But the way we talk about accessibility, the terminology we use, even in the papers, is not a comfortable terminology. And we need to me, accessibility is a very, very powerful frame for all the things we're trying to achieve, but we haven't actually found the words yet. To do that. And the example that I often give, it's a conversation, right, about redefining what the social utility of transportation is. So when I was working on energy issues in the 1970s, that happened. And it happened because a guy named Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute was able to explain in a very simple way that people do not care about energy because they care about kilowatts, right? He said, people care about energy because they care about heat, light, and power. And that became the mantra. And if you could get heat, light, and power by using less energy or by conserving energy or by tapping the sun, no one cared. The thing they wanted was heat, light, and power. Give them heat, light, and power differently. And it really reframed the energy conversation in this country. We talk about transportation, even people who believe in accessibility, when you actually listen to the words they use, in terms of mobility. We assume that movement is actually the social utility provided by the transportation system. The way that you know that this is true, that this is false, right, as false as the belief that the kilowatt is the social utility of the energy system, is how many people do you know who wake up every morning and say, I would like to travel 83.2 miles today? You know none. How many people do you know that wake up and say, I need to get the kids to school, I need to get to work, I need to pick up groceries, and I'd love to go for a run after work? Everyone. The problem is we haven't figured out how to talk about that second thing in a way that is as succinct, as compelling as heat, light, and power.
Thank you. So, Gilles, we've heard from people that are in the day-to-day work of transportation. You bring to us the point of view of real estate development, of land use development, of urban development, among others. You have a wide-ranging background. You've worked in Columbia as an advisor. You've worked in many other areas. Does this resonate in terms of the some of the barriers? Are we asking the right questions? How do we get the pressure or perhaps the momentum to make those culture changes if it's not going to come from the transportation sector per se? What are the other levers that we might want to use?
Okay, thank you very much. When we started writing this paper with Eric, we started making this silo argument, and we were afraid that we were just from academia, we didn't really live in those agencies, and we didn't really live in city management, so we were very well afraid of being all making a big caricature. And then I heard Stephanie, who was like even way worse in her assessments.
Sorry. Really.
So let me start first. I mean, Adair said very rightly that we spend 17% of our disposable incomes on transportation, 95% of which is road transportation. American households also spend an hour 30 each every day going places. So this is 5 to 10% of our time awake. These are extraordinary amounts of resources. And yes, people dealing with that, they come in two different groups. We have the transportation planners who indeed, their main objective is about going faster. And, you know, this is, at some level, this is a very well-laudable goal. I mean, we'd like to be able to go faster. You know, reaching your destination faster is important. It matters. At the same time, what is somewhat accessory to the plot in their mind is the fact that when we go places, when we travel, we create all sorts of external effects. We create congestion. We, unfortunately, create accidents. We pollute, and so on and so forth. And this is to the tune of about, 10 cents per mile. These are the best estimates, which means that if we aggregate that to the whole country, this is about $1 billion every day. So this is a very large amount of money and resources that we actually lose. And this is sort of secondary to the plot for the transportation planners. The other thing that is really important to realize is if you actually make travel faster, you lower the price. And when the price goes down, I'm an economist, I expect the consumers to be willing to consume more of it. So at some level, this is a good problem to have, but there's a self-defeating aspect here. As you actually improve, as you provide more infrastructure, people will drive more. I think I wrote some interesting things here, or I saw some interesting things here in the data, where basically, the amount of traffic on the main roads in this country, highways and principal arterials, is basically proportional to the amount of roads of lane kilometers of those roads. So this is there's a self-defeating element here. The other group are land use planners. That's an interesting group. That's culturally indeed a very well different group. I mean, the first group were mostly transportation engineers. The others are urban planners, architects. It's a very different sort of culture. And I think they understand indeed that there are some problems with transportation, that it pollutes, that it congests, that it creates accidents and all of this. What they've also realized over the years is that there's no silver bullet. So what I think the direction they took, which I don't really like, is let's make transportation unnecessary by bringing stuff close to people. So I like this idea. The problem is that very often they take it to extremes, and the extreme of that vision is this very middle-aged sort of vision where people will be working on the first floor and live on the second floor. This is just not how we live. This is not just how we live, so this is not going to work. So I like the idea of making stuff closer, because going faster is one idea, but making stuff closer is indeed another idea. The problem is that they never do that together, so there's no coordination. Whenever I go to a policy discussion about this, there's always a smart person who says, but we need a more holistic approach. I really hate that word. I really hate that word, because then we quickly go into some mumbo jumbo, and we're losing both the discipline of transportation planners and the discipline of urban planners, and we enter in some world where it's where it's not working very well and people will not do great things. So indeed, we need to recognize that this is about both distances and speed and ease of transportation. So do I have a plan well of action? I think there are some low-hanging fruits here. A lot of this country is zoned what we call in the jargon Euclidean, i.e. one big area, one use, pure residential, pure commercial, pure retail. You know, yes, we don't want noxious land use in residential areas. I don't want a chemical factory next to my house. But beyond that, there's a big argument about mixed use, or at least maybe not always try well to rapidly well foster it like some people would like to do, but at least making sure if we want to have mixed use, we can actually have it. Then there's another thing that makes us travel long distances in this country, it's minimum lot size. A lot of the suburbs in this country are zoned half an acre, quarter of an acre, three quarter, one full acre, and sometimes even more. And, you know, individually, we may not want to consume that much land. We actually make that zoning for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with transportation. That's going to be really hard to get rid of that one because this is what actually will govern the way we choose locations so that our kids can go to good schools. We don't want all the riffraff to come to nice places. So that's the way we actually exclude people, by forcing them to consume very large amounts of land. But in terms of transportation, this is self-defeating. This is making us travel way more than we should. The third thing I want to talk about is, indeed, we need more science. I mean, that was sort of transparent in your speech. I know this is not the right place to talk about more science and certainly not the right week, as the flat earthers are actually going to take over. But we still need to do more science. Accessibility, I think in simple words, is about where people choose to go relative to where they could have chosen to go. So it means, and there are questions before this one, which is their choice of motorization, whether or not to buy a car, their residential choices, and so on and so forth. But this is really, again, where people choose to go, given where they could have gone, given the opportunities that they face. So the Department of Transportation has a nice survey. I think the next wave is coming live very soon, where indeed we observe where people go to. We have now the technology actually that allows us to also understand where they could have gone to. So we know that so-and-so on that day decided to go to the restaurant at 7 p.m., whatever, 6 miles away from home. He could have gone to, or she could have gone to a restaurant only 2 miles or 7 miles. We actually now have the data to be able to actually analyze those choices and make progress on that. So it's going to be hard, it's going to be difficult, but I think we can make progress. So despite the flat earthers, yet it moves indeed. So somebody said that many centuries ago, and moving indeed is not utility in itself, but it's actually what allows us to live reasonable and interesting lives.
So let me turn to Secretary Mendez to pose this question. When we talk about these new ways of thinking about land use and the like, we also see the underbelly, the negative underbelly, which is gentrification, which is increased access to transportation, increasing land values, which are then pushing people out to further away from access to transportation. You have some interesting work going on, or at least have seen some of this going on in the south side of Buenos Aires, where you've got low-income communities that are increasingly being pushed out of the city and increasingly pushed out away from transportation networks, access to the goods and services that they need. What are the dynamics that are working there, not just on the transportation side, but on the land use side and the real estate side, and what's the city doing about it?
Well, the situation of the southern neighborhood of the city of Buenos Aires, it took a holistic approach from the city government in terms that we have to join efforts of our department, transport planning, with urban planning and economic development at the city government. And, for example, when we introduced the southern corridor of the BRT, the Metrobus, in the southern neighborhoods of the city, we didn't face the typical capacity problem that usually arises and the response is a BRT. But the BRT addressed other issues like accessibility to mass transit. The bus routes were operating in terms of speed and capacity very well, but the quality of services was very poor. So introducing the BRT stations with the renewal of the public space, the reclaiming of the public space for better uses and higher quality, improved the quality of the neighborhoods. Also, the urban planning department and the economic development department, they introduced the creation of a specific development area for IT companies, reducing taxes and inducing those companies to move to the southern neighborhoods of Buenos Aires and start mixing activities. It used to be only a residential neighborhood with some businesses related to logistic practices. We create a logistic center to move those isolated practices around the neighborhood into a logistic facility. And then those spaces are now being reconverted into offices or new houses for these new businesses that are coming to the neighborhoods, which are also better connected than it used to be in the past. And this approach was very helpful, but it didn't fulfill all our requirements in terms of integrating low-income communities. We have slums in Buenos Aires, very big slums, and regulated settlements of low-income neighbors that we're now addressing in terms of integrating them to the city. And the process of integration, it's also require a holistic approach. It's not only opening roads and getting transportation into these new neighborhoods, but also redevelopment in terms of land use and the quality of infrastructure. They really deserve to be a neighborhood and to have the same standard of the rest of the city. Right now, neighbors of these slums are spending more money in real terms than the rest of the neighbors of the city, because usually the last mile or the last 1.5 or 2 kilometers to the regular or the mass transit system is served by some type of private unregulated transportation supply that is very expensive. Is sometimes unsafe because it's not regulated, is performing very poorly. And in order to access to the city and to what the city has to offer, they had to spend more money. So we had to address that situation also in order to connect these neighborhoods with the existing mass transit network. So
wonderful to see that actually, notwithstanding the holistic, there is actually an example where the city has come together from the various points of view. So it gives a little bit of hope that this can happen. I haven't been able to ask questions on finances, on fiscal, on public-private partnerships, on metrics. There's so many things that we can cover because now it's time for the audience. So we have about 10 minutes for audience questions. I'd ask you to please keep it very short, to please introduce yourself. If there's a specific person you're addressing the question to, please let us know. Otherwise, we'll open up to the panel. I'm going to take a few questions, and then we'll round it through. So please raise your hands, and let me see. I have this gentleman right front here.
Hi, Steve Kaplan. Am I right, the Buenos Aires bus system is largely or uses private bus companies in its mass transit? My question is there a place for private ownership and management of mass transit in urban environments?
Okay, well, we'll take a few questions. Other questions? Way in the back.
Ma'am, take the microphone, please.
Like a community.
Yes, thank you.
We are a community of intellectuals and thinkers here. So,
can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Maureen. I'm taking my doctorate in nursing in Rutgers University.
Thank you.
And I do FMCA, Certified Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration Medical Examiner. My question is, we're a group of intellectuals here. The bottom line is, when you talk to the public, the first question is, it's traffic. George Washington Bridge, Garden State Parkway, Atlantic City Expressway. So how do we fix traffic? Because it affects our quality of life. When we go to Vienna, Austria, Germany, they have excellent transport system. What is wrong with the United States that we can fix it?
Thank you very much. Yes?
Hi, thank you. My name is Emmy Kalawale. I run a human-centered design consultancy called Design LLC. I was wondering, is it a storytelling problem that is happening here? I hear a lot about we need data collection, we need to know more data, more data, more data, but it also sounds like the story about transportation is being told badly, if it's even being told at all. And I'm wondering, is this a storytelling problem or a data problem, or is it a combination of both, and which one comes first?
One more question here.
Lynn Scholl from the Inter-American Development Bank. My question is about the discounted fare for poor populations. How does that work? How do you identify the poor? How does the targeting work? And how can we do that in other cities and developing countries? Because often it's hard to figure out who are the poor because there aren't easy ways to target. So I'm wondering how the discount works.
Thank you so much. Let's turn back to our panelists. Secretary Mendez, I'll ask you to perhaps reflect on the issue of privatization, the private ownership of mass transit, but in particular, does it help or not help? Does it make your life more complicated or less complicated when you're trying to fix this or to have an accessibility-led transportation system?
Well, in this long-standing tradition of mass transit in the city of Buenos Aires, the private sector always played a key role in the development of the system. Subway lines, they were promoted by private companies at the beginning, and the same happens with the bus routes. And we've been having private operators like for many years now, and even though we changed the first schemes till the end of the 90s, the first were covered 100% by passengers, now they are subsidized by the federal government. If you set the right incentives, private operators tend to be very efficient and tend to be a very important part of the equation. So for us, it was very useful to have them, although we had so many issues and discussions along the way, but it was very helpful. This is a system of 18,000 buses and almost 200 bus routes, which is very very broad and hard to manage. And in terms of how we recognize or we work to offer social fare to low-income communities, the federal government administration for social benefits, like pensions, and they have specific programs for assistance to low-income communities. And in those programs, they already, in the past 12 to 13 years, they've been working very hard identifying these communities in order to grant them assistance. So we have a one fare collection system that is called SUBE, and it's available for the entire mass transit system. And what we did in the past year was to introduce into the SUBE car the social fare specific, I don't know how to say, but we introduced in the supercar the social fare program, and they only have to link the supercar with their income or taxes identification number, and they automatically receive the social fare discount. It was very easy for the mass transit system because this federal administration was working very properly in the past 10 years identifying the low-income communities.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask Secretary Pollack and Professor Durantan to tell us about the storytelling. We read in the papers, or those of you, I refer to one of the excellent papers in this series that talked about how difficult it is to find metrics and to find common denominators and common definitions and the like. So that's a bit of the data piece. Is that, really a fundamental problem, or is it the problem that Secretary Pollack raised, which is we're just not telling this story right? We're not capturing people's. We don't have a narrative. So it's probably a bit of both. But Secretary Pollack.
I do think it is a bit of both, and I think that so in public policy, we tend to call telling a story right framing. So what we're talking about is moving from a frame called mobility to a frame called accessibility, right? And so words matter, right? So when we make the statement, right, the way I describe to my staff, what do we do? What does my agency do? I say we help people get where they need to go safely and reliably. Now, that's not a bad frame, but it's a mobility frame. And you know that it is because I use the words get, go, and where, right? In an accessibility frame, what we actually should be in the business of doing is helping people get what they need. It's not a where, right? It's not a move. It's a get what they need. Now, that doesn't take mobility out of the picture, right? Because honestly, even in an accessibility world, the number one tool for achieving accessibility is still going to be movement, right? You go to your job. You go to your children's school. But what an accessibility, what reframing it and sort of changing the narrative, and again, using words that make sense to people, not academics, is it opens up a set of tools. So I'll very briefly just mention this. And this actually goes to the privatization question. More in for the mobility piece of accessibility, for those things that people need access to that require movement, we live in a wonderful time in the transportation world because there are so many more mobility options and many of them are privately provided, right? We did not have Uber. We did not have Lyft. We did not have bike sharing. We did not have cars to go. Those are all mobility tools with the potential to increase accessibility. And it is a good thing, not a bad thing, that the private sector is providing some of them because it allows the public sector to focus on other things. So mobility still matters, and the private sector can be a huge provider of mobility. In the field now, it's being called mobility on demand, and that is a good thing, not a bad thing. We need more of it. But the interesting thing about accessibility is mobility is you've done a ways, you know, an ends and means shift, right? So in a mobility world, the end is movement. In an accessibility world, the end is getting what you need. And one way of doing that, so the easy example to think about, which is an accessibility and a social equity issue, is there's a family with very little money that lives in a neighborhood where there is no fresh produce available to them to eat a healthy diet. In an accessibility world, you have at least three ways of helping that family. And in a transportation agency, telling them that that's part of their job is to figure out how to help that family get access to affordable, healthy food comes as a surprise. But if you accept that that's actually an accessibility objective, a mobility answer is to subsidize travel so they can get to wherever the fresh groceries is. That's a mobility answer. Or to have a new provider, including a private provider, come in and provide a connection to the grocery store or for the grocery store itself to realize that there is a market and move people. That's a mobility answer. The moving stuff closer is usually referred to as a proximity answer, right? So that's putting grocery stores in food deserts. Again, not seen as a transportation function, but clearly an accessibility thing. So that's proximity. And then the third thing, and again, we live in an age where this is so possible, right, is you stay exactly where you are and things come to you. I don't know that we have a great name for that one yet. We need to tell that story. But in Boston, it consists of a group of students at a college who graduated, bought a bus, outfitted it with racks, go and buy produce, and they drive it around like what I remember from my childhood is as the bookmobile. So in low-income neighborhoods in Boston, produce appears. And so the people stay, but the thing they need moves to them, not on a permanent basis, which is proximity, by opening the store. So that's why, to me, this telling the story differently is so exciting, because as soon as you live in an accessibility world, there are so many more solutions to the problems that we all care so much about.
So let me, the final word to Professor Dorantan DeGille. Metrics, is it the storytelling or the metrics? We heard quite a bit about the storytelling side. Is there still room for metrics? And very quickly, because we're about to move on to our next section.
Well, I'm going to be certainly biased. I mean, I live in academia and I actually really enjoy working with the metrics. So I'm going to be biased on that one. What I don't like about the storytelling is that it's presented more and more in this country and certainly in other well-advanced countries in terms of war on car, where you have those two factions, for or against. which actually goes back to the two silos that we've talked about before. So I don't think, well, this debate is very well productive, so I'm trying to go beyond that. And there's lots more options, but there's also new ideas and new things that are developed in other parts of the world that we should be looking at. And BRT in Buenos Aires, which actually started in Curitiba, well, Brazil, was adopted, well, massively, well, in Bogota. This is an extraordinary system. So I don't know. I mean, I've been, well, to Buenos Aires, well, well, several times, and I'll be back, well, next month, but I know, well, Bogota, well, very well. So this is a transportation system that is actually moving around more people than the London Underground in terms of passenger miles. So this is an extraordinary system, and all this is for the cost of 5 or 6 miles of New York subway at the current tune. So this is, well, a system that is actually extraordinarily, well, impressive. So they can clock one bus, one large-scale bus, well, every minute or less. Here, well, last time, I spoke to a transportation, well, planner that was in Vancouver, and the guy was so proud, well, that he could get a bus every 90 seconds. And I thought, yeah, but in Bogota, it's 50, 55 seconds. So there's lots of ideas, there's lots of practices that actually elsewhere, well, in the world, and the big novelty here is that the developing world is making big headways for lots and lots of things.
Maybe that answers a bit of our question on traffic and what's going on in other countries. I want you all to join me in thanking our panelists, Secretary Mendez, Secretary Pollack, Professor Jerome Tau, for bringing some real-world examples and experience to the presentation that we heard earlier. It's now time for us to leave the stage and for me to welcome on stage Vice President of Metropolitan Program, Amy Liu, who has the honor of introducing our next guest, the Honorable Anthony Fox, U.S. Secretary of Transportation. Amy, thank you.
Okay.
Great. Good morning. And I don't think I need to introduce Secretary Fox. I think many of you know him very well, and he's also a former mayor of a large city, the mayor of Charlotte, which makes us even bigger fans of his work. Secretary Fox, welcome back to Brookings.
Glad to be here, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
And we've had a great discussion this morning about how we need to do a better job, both here in the U.S. and around the world, in making our transportation infrastructure built environment policies more people-centric. And yet there are so many barriers for doing that. And so I want to explore some of those themes with you this morning. But I want to start with a question about just your global experience, because this is a global project, a project between our program and the Global Economic Development Program here at Brookings. Have you done a lot of international travel?
I've done quite a bit, actually, Amy. Transportation is an international language, and whenever you go to another country and you see how they're using mobility, or practicing mobility is a better way to say it, you can actually learn a lot. So
Where have you been?
So we've gone to spent some time in Germany, the UK, India, Australia, Japan, Scandinavia, South America. I've been to both Brazil and to Argentina. So I've gotten a pretty good sample of what's around the world.
And what have you observed from those travels about what makes the U.S. system and policy strong, and what can we do better?
Well, I think it's fair to say, just on a comparative basis, that our transportation system is more mature than a lot of other countries' systems are. On the other hand, that gives us certain advantages because we don't have to worry as much on a day-to-day basis about building it out, even though there are things we still need to do. On the other hand, the other countries have the advantages of learning from our mistakes. And, you know, for example, you know, in Amsterdam, which now has a great bicycle culture, mm-hmm. It wasn't always that way. Back in the 60s and before, they were very auto-centric, and they just made the decision to convert to a bicycle culture, and people bought into it, and now they're kind of known for it, and you'd never know they have cars. So I think there's a lot that we can learn about mobility from other places, because everyone's being challenged by population explosions in the urban regions and the need to move people around better.
And so let's talk about the switch from mobility to accessibility.
Yes.
This program has been about the fact that our entire system is focused on movement, VMTs, cars, mm-hmm. and less about the way people actually move about their day. Mm-hmm. You have made accessibility a priority for you at DOT. Tell us why, and tell us a little bit about the work you've done. And I think ladders of opportunity is sort of at the center of that.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at our system, we have, again, a very mature system, but we also have stacked into our system certain prejudices about certain geographic areas and so forth. And so you can go to many cities and you can look at where the freeways are lined up and you can see the evidence of what people thought about those areas, and in most cases not that much. And you can look at our transit systems, and in transit a lot of times the challenges we have are the stops that didn't get put in place. It's more of an issue of omission usually than commission necessarily. But these mobility challenges hit people every single day. You know, if you live in a underserved area and your job is across town, like, for example, in Richmond, Virginia, where between the hours of 7:30 and 9:30, something like, I think it's like 24% of the people on the west side of Richmond are not served by transit, and most of the jobs are on the east side. So people are trying to figure out how to get from one place to another. So it affects, you know, if you're poor in this country, it's an expensive thing to be poor. Transportation eats up a second highest amount of your wallet. Everything's an aggravation. You have to take multiple transfers to get from one place to another. If your kid gets sick, you got to figure out a way to get to work but also deal with a sick kid. So it's just, it's a miserable experience, and it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. As a country, if we build the intentionality around our system and try to help people more, then folks will have an easier time.
So then tell us about ladders of opportunity. Yeah. What have you been doing to try to create now a much-needed culture shift across the country this way?
So there's sort of an offense and a defense to it. On the offensive side, we've tried to do the things to help communities reimagine transportation as more accessible. So, for example, you and others have done studies that show the challenges of income mobility in certain areas. And we picked 7 of the cities that were lowest performing in terms of, if you're poor, how easy is it to get into the middle class? We picked 7 of the lowest performers, and we did a pilot called Ladder Step. We asked the mayors of these cities to come up with a transportation project that they thought could make a difference. And those cities were like Indianapolis, Baltimore, Baton Rouge, Atlanta, Phoenix. I'm going to miss somebody, mm-hmm. but I'm sorry. Anyway, we picked 7. They picked 7 projects, and we're working on them. And they're at various phases of coming into existence. But the whole idea is...
Can you give us an example? Like, what's an example of a really good project that can help us move closer to accessing people?
So one example is in Indianapolis. There's a series of neighborhoods that are in sort of the southern part of the city. And the jobs are in the northern part of the region, not just the city, but even a little bit outside the city. So the mayor had the idea of putting a bus rapid transit line that would mm-hmm. connect folks from that part to the northern part of the city. And that project is in development today. So we have lots of things like that that we're doing. So part of it is like seeing is believing. So if we can get it on the ground, people see it, they become national examples. We've also done things like the Every Place Counts Design Challenge. We went to 4 areas. I got to go to Philadelphia to meet with some folks whose neighborhood had been carved up by a freeway, and they were sitting right next to the State Department of Transportation folks, and they were actually talking about how to reimagine that community. And so I think those types of experiences then begin to help the planning process be more informed by the range of choices. On the defensive side, we have Title VI is one of our most important tools to ensure fairness in the use of federal dollars in transportation. Our guidance on Title VI has not been updated for 40 years. Mm-hmm. We just updated it. And we're also trying to move to a more proactive position with our NEPA process so that we're not encouraging DOTs to decide what they want to do and then have public input, but to have that public input before the decisions are made. So mm-hmm. we're trying to engage the public, and hopefully some of the offensive things we've done have created more of a conversation.
One of the things that was raised today and in the research is the importance of performance metrics, that the performance metrics in the system now make it really difficult to change our investment programs and investment approaches and who we collaborate with. It's focused on, you know, how well you're doing in terms of repairs or VMTs and speed. If we focus more on access and people, affordability, opportunity, what, have you started to experiment with metrics?
Yeah, we have. We actually are still trying to figure out how you do measure mm-hmm. the people impact of projects, you know. We can measure the number of cars that go through an interchange. We can measure cost effectiveness of various projects using certain economic criteria. But what we tell engineers to build the system and make as many vehicles go through it as possible. But we also ought to be telling our engineers, you have to look at this project from a 360-degree perspective. You know, how is it going to impact the communities that touch it? What are the plans to ensure good connectivity? I'll give you one real mm-hmm. concrete example from my neck of the woods. I-77 in the downtown area of Charlotte plowed through a historically African-American community right in the center of town. And today there's an overpass, and the overpass is like this dark, dim thing. And if you lived in the neighborhood, you wouldn't want to walk under that underpass because you'd have no idea what would happen to you if you did. And so the city, working with the state, has now put in a light fixture in there, and it looks more inviting. And, you know, sometimes it's simple things like that. Sometimes it's more dramatic where you might tunnel something that's over the landscape. But we have to start thinking about these things more holistically because, frankly, for cities and communities, land values have been depressed because of some of this building. Communities have been cut up because of this, and it's frankly a little unnecessary. And I'll add one more thing to this since I've got like 8 more days.
Keep going.
I said this at TRB the other day, but you know, one of the things that our country needs to think about in terms of performance metrics and economies and so forth is right now we are chronically underinvesting in our infrastructure, whether it's repair or new capacity. Everybody says it, everybody knows it. One thing we haven't had a real conversation about is what can we do without? And I happen to think that if we actually got rigorous about it and looked at our street grids, our east-west, north-south street grids in our cities, that there are some freeways that run in the interior of our cities where there's probably no traffic advantage to having the freeway there. And restoring the old street grid might actually be as efficient or more efficient than having that freeway running through it. And it has the added value of reconnecting communities.
It's so interesting because we've had that same conversation on the housing side. We so much reward new housing starts.
Yeah.
And yet we don't spend as much time talking about redevelopment and renovation and the power of reuse. So I think it's really powerful to think about that. Speaking of eight more days.
Eight more days.
Let me transition and talk about your exit memo.
Yeah,
I really
sure.
enjoyed it. And not because you're exiting, by the way, but because there are...
I was wondering. I was like, but, I don't know, man.
But because there are really great progress and a lot of more challenges to come. And
sure.
as our, as President Obama said last night, this is a really a step in a really long journey. And so in your memo, you talked about three priorities or things that we need to keep an eye out. Funding, technology, and really who benefits, the access question. So we've already talked about access.
Yeah.
So let me just talk about the other two.
Sure.
There's no doubt how we pay for things is a constant question, particularly in an environment where not only is it thin at the federal level, but states and localities are really struggling. Tell me about, in the last, you know, under your watch, what have you all been doing to help states and cities really find leverage or resources to pay for a wide array of infrastructure projects?
So the first and foremost thing that that we did was something that's really hard to do, which was to build a national urgency behind getting a floor under us with transportation investment. And that was... we did several things. We went on a national bus tour twice. We hit 100 communities, 43 states. We went to places, you know, they weren't just like Democratic centers of the universe. We went to like Janesville, Wisconsin, where Paul Ryan's from. We went to Kentucky and Louisville, where Leader McConnell is from. And so we wanted to make the case to everybody. And I think that was part of why Congress came back and passed the FAST Act, and President Obama signed it on December 4th, 2015, which now provides us at least a floor for the next several years in transportation funding. At the same time, both I and the President were interested in how we could leverage more public-private partnerships in transportation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conversation about that now. I'll just tell you, without editorializing too much, that I do think there is some room for more public-private partnerships in transportation. Do I think we can get 100% of the gap between where we are and where we need to be? No, but you know, is it 10%? Is it 15%? Maybe. And so we have consolidated our credit programs within one roof. We've created a Build America Bureau that now has an executive director, and it is going to make the process of moving through a public-private partnership much easier without compromising some of the things that many of us care about, which are like environmental aspects and so forth. But this is going to be very effective. So the infrastructure is there to do more. But on the larger question of funding and what the future is, you know, we've got to deal with the political reality that people are paying for bad transportation system today, and whether it's like having to buy new tires more frequently or using more fuel because the road systems are inefficient and you're stuck in traffic for a long time. I don't think it's, and unfortunately, it sometimes gets cast as a choice between paying more taxes and nothing. But the reality is most people are paying something for the inefficiency of the system today. The last thing I want to point out here is that you could put $5 trillion into the transportation system. But if we're buying the wrong stuff for the future that we're walking into, then we're still going to have a problem. And I've been arguing more for a demand-driven approach to transportation, where instead of presupposing that 80 cents on every highway trust fund dollar should go to roads, we ought to be much more flexible at the federal level and let states have more a say at how they split that. Put some of that money or some of the additional money we find into regions and into cities so that they can do things that the states may be slower at doing, but they need to do. So I just think we just need to have a reset on the policy side, and I hope that in the future the conversation isn't just about how much money and where it's coming from.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I marveled about this conversation earlier today about the fact that we do have a lot of infrastructure needs in our country. Mm-hmm. There's a huge conversation about financing in the form of it, but we don't talk enough about what are we paying, what is that funding for?
Yeah.
And are we structuring the finance to reflect the built environment we want? And how do we bridge those conversations more? Do you have advice about that? I think that's what you're saying, is how do you bring those two conversations together?
And I want to be very careful because I get asked sometimes, you know, what would you like to continue doing if you had a few more years? And then somebody writes, Fox gives Chow advice or whatever. That's not what I'm doing. But I think you're asking a very important question, which is how do we have a broader conversation about the policy side? And I think... Yeah. One of the things that I think needs to happen is that we need a coalition of mayors and governors thinking about this, because they're the ones on whom the responsibility is ultimately going to lie to reshuffle the deck. I also think the transportation community as such is kind of splintered. And so there's a road lobby, there's a transit lobby, there's a rail lobby, but they almost always are arguing their own case and not the case for the system. And the problem with that is that when they go to the Hill or they try to get something done, it's not going to be integrated. You know, if our road systems are just being judged on roads and not being judged on overall mobility and access, then we probably won't get mobility and access. But if we actually, getting to your point on measures, we start measuring the things that we want and we're more flexible about how we get there, then we have a chance to get the 21st century transportation system everybody wants.
Let's talk about, we've got 5 more minutes before we open up to questions, so please keep thinking about what you want to ask our secretary. Let's talk about the disruptive nature of technology. I think sometimes people outside of maybe autonomous vehicles aren't truly prepared for what is to come. Tell this group what you see coming down in terms of the role of technology and its impact on infrastructure in the built environment.
Well, I think, you know, when I was a mayor, I used to say about water, which is another type of infrastructure, to say if the faucet comes on and no one thinks about me, then I've done my job. and I think that's the way people think about transportation. And so we have the advantage in a mature transportation system, as many holes as we have in it, potholes included, we do have the advantage of not thinking about it as much. Now what's happening with technology is, I think, a wave of choices now coming in. And they kind of, right now, they're kind of like superficial choices, like, you know, do I drive? Do I get a ride share? Do I get a cab? You're thinking about it that way. In the future, though, we're going to have significant changes in personal mobility with the car, and it's going to have implications. Certainly, from our vantage point, safety is first and foremost, and so trying to put some shape around safety as a priority as this mm-hmm. technology emerges is part of what we do, which is why we produce the first in the world national comprehensive autonomous vehicle policy that lays a framework for that. And it starts to answer questions like, for example, today you and I drive cars. We have to go to DMV, and everybody loves to go to DMV, I know. We go to DMV to get our license. Well, what if the software is driving the car? So who's going to license that? And what we've said is that to the extent the software is operating the vehicle, the federal government will evaluate that. And the states don't need to trouble themselves with that. But to the extent a human being is driving the car, you still need a license. So we do that. I think beyond that, though, there are other questions, which is, what is the future of future ownership of cars, period? You know, to what extent are we going to want to own a car versus owning a service that gets us where we're going? You know, a lot of people quote the statistic that cars are like idle like 95% of the time. So, you know, do you want to put the investment into buying something that you're not using 95% of the time, or do you want to just buy what you use? That could transform things. And then the younger generation, coupled with the boomers, who are finding ways to live closer in, have the conveniences of being able to walk or bike places, how are they going to behave in this new world? And are their tastes going to change? I don't know that that necessarily means a net decrease in auto sales, although it probably does. But maybe those sales are business-to-business sales and not business-to-consumer as much as they have been. So I think there's going to be a lot of disruption around here. And I also think that if we're smart and we figure out how to do what I said, which is to be more demand-driven, you're going to see much more transit activity in places like the Southeast, where I'm from, and the Western states where there's such population growth that's exploding. You should see more regional conversation about freight movements, and you're going to see trucks that are also taking advantage of autonomous technology. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that I think are going to happen. They're going to really change things, and we need to also be focused on labor and the fact that this is going to also introduce some challenges with our workforce.
So one more question before we go to the audience.
Sure.
You all invested in a smart city.
Yeah.
Challenge and program, and Columbus was the lucky community for that initiative. What are you learning from Columbus? What are they doing to sort of be at the forefront of integrating this technology? And is access on their minds?
So one thing that we did with the Smart City Challenge was we actually put access in as one of the criteria, and that actually had some really important lessons that we drew just from the application process. Several cities, for example, including Columbus, came up with this idea of a single pay app or function where if you're trying to get from here to your doctor's office and you've got to take a bus and then a train and then a ride share to get door to door, that you pay one time for that trip and it's all seamlessly put together for you. And I think you're going to see that happen in a lot of cities around the country and probably the world. The other thing that that they did in Columbus that I thought was really compelling is Columbus has four times the national rate of infant mortality. And it was an issue before the Smart City Challenge, and they were very aware of it. What they endeavor to do is to create an app where mom can get her doctor's appointment at the same time the trip is generated. And, you know, if the bus is late or something, the app automatically contacts the doctor's office and gets the appointment rescheduled. But they're thinking about how to connect people. And the last thing that Columbus did on the equity point is, what if you don't have a cell phone? What if you don't have a bank account? You know, a lot of people who are poor don't have either one. And so they're experimenting with kiosks in certain corridors where you know there's a high poverty population, and those folks will have access to these same services through area kiosks. So those are just a few things on the equity point. I think the Smart City Challenge was one of the coolest things we've done. Mm-hmm. We got 78 applications from all over the country, and the whole point of it was to get the country to reimagine transportation. And so now you've got 78 cities that have come up with ideas and plans, and many of them are just going ahead with them. So I like to say that we didn't have any losers in that competition.
Great. Okay, it's your turn. Any questions for Secretary Fox?
Yeah.
I'm going to call on two. I'm going to call Giles and over here and introduce yourself. And keep your questions tight.
Yeah, Gilles Duranton from the Wharton School. Let me ask a funding question, because as a foreigner, I'm always mesmerized by the way it works in this country. So you have a gas tax that's very, very low, and we could argue whether it should be higher. I mean, I think it should be higher. But then the pot goes on Capitol Hill, and you have some politicians that fight basically to get stuff back into their state, but they also essentially decide to fund particular projects. I view that as just bizarre. So one of a completely different alternative, which is the country I'm coming from, the money actually goes to your peer over there, and essentially There are some engineers below that decide, okay, we're going to allocate the money this year to do this, and that, completely outside of the political process on the day-to-day decisions. An alternative that might be way more suitable well to this country would actually be let the gas tax and states do whatever they want, go to the states, and let the states will decide whatever they want to do with that money. And if they want to invest a lot in transportation, they can. If they want to invest little, well, they can as well.
So,
let him ask his question, okay. And then we'll let you do both.
Thank you. My name is Dan Vak. I'm a reporter with Governing. Getting to your point about smart cities, I just talked to someone from Austin yesterday. He said one of the greatest things about it was that here he was, a city official, talking to all the top people at USDOT. It seems you're a former mayor. There's been a lot of sort of elevation of cities and city departments of transportation. You've even talked about changing the funding on that. How do you sort of continue to get and keep cities in the conversation? I think that's been one of the big focuses of your tenure here.
Thank you. So on the first question, you know, it's I can't fully explain our political system. except to say that, you know, we released this report called Beyond Traffic, and the final draft of it came out Monday. And part of what we're trying to do as an agency is to rationalize the data and the facts with decision making. And that's painful in America because people are used to what they're used to. You know, and I think part of our challenge is that most of our policies and funding have grown up around getting the system built. They haven't necessarily grown up around trying to integrate the system. And that's where we are right now, is we're kind of stuck in build mode as if it's 1956, instead of being in a mode of how do we optimize the freeways, the local streets, the sidewalks, the bike lanes, et cetera. So we've tried to push people towards thinking about that more, and it's an ongoing challenge. On this question, we have worked hard to get local government more involved in what we do. And part of that is because, just from a macro economic standpoint, our cities are becoming more of the organizers of our economy. And the regions in which they sit are not just urban, they're suburban, they're rural. And if we can figure out mobility solutions in those regions, we will figure out the nation's transportation system. And so although I didn't get a whole lot of like hearts for the MPO rule that we just put out there, there weren't a lot of love notes sent to us. Part of the reason we did that is because, you know, we're not, in my opinion, going to solve this so-called urban-rural divide in Washington, D.C. We have to deal with that in a region-by-region way. And, you know, pushing neighbors together to problem solve together is actually not a bad thing. It's probably different than what we're used to, but we need to push our regions to plan more collaboratively, not just coordinate, but to plan together.
All right, other questions? Let's go to the two in the back of the room, these glasses and this young man here. Yeah.
Hi, Anson Stewart. I'm a doctoral candidate at MIT. First, thanks for mentioning the cost of doing nothing. I think that really ties into the accessibility point of view. Some of the things we've looked at in Boston include unreliable access to healthcare centers causing late arrivals to appointment, missed appointments, like you mentioned. And that has a huge cost kind of from the social point of view. On the previous panel, Secretary Pollack made the observation that given agency culture, shifting to more of an accessibility paradigm may require a lot more kind of advocacy, public participation, and organizing. So given that, And given the fact that kind of new private actors are in many cases starting to control the data that are needed to make some of those arguments, what role could government have in supporting open data, open data standards, and open APIs to help enable some of that organizing and participation from the public? Thanks.
I'll take that one question in the back. I think the gentleman, the glasses right there. Yep. Nope, behind him. Sorry. To the back. Yes, that's two. Fair.
Hi, Keith Bartholomew, University of Utah, and I want to thank the Secretary for his comments this morning and joining us. Referencing also to Secretary Pollack, she noted a linguistic problem, and others have referred to a narrative gap in shifting from mobility talk to accessibility talk. And Secretary Pollack referenced Emery Lovin's excellent quip that people don't care about kilowatts, they care about hot pizza and cold beer. How do we talk about accessibility in something less than a paragraph?
So on both of these points, I think I learned something when I went to Copenhagen. We were there with a group, an architectural firm that gets involved in transportation planning, and whose name escapes me, but they are using a public input model that I think is really interesting, and we're trying to put in place guidance that allows for this. But basically, today our public input process works like, okay, we're going to have a meeting at 4 o'clock at the government center, and everybody show up, and if you show up, you can, you know, look at the maps and comment on them. Now, how well we use that input is really, you leave it to your imagination, but that's the way the public input process works today. What they were showing us were some ways that you can actually go out to where people are already, whether it's a coffee shop or a community meeting that has maybe nothing to do with transportation, and talk about transportation with people in a way that uses their language, not ours. Mm-hmm. And I think that we will see in the near future, not too distant future, not only localities experimenting with more outward ways of seeking public input, but also hopefully some of the states trying to experiment with that. And we've tried to create room in our department to allow for that. I think the public doesn't use the transportation vernacular. And it's really important for us as transportation practitioners to talk to people in the language that they use, not ours. And I think that's an evolution that we are just on the front end of.
We have room for time for one more. Oh, one more. Karen tells me one more.
Okay.
A lot of great questions. Let me do this. Can we do this one? Yeah.
Hi, Secretary. Thank you so much for your time. My name is Emmy Kalawale. I run a human-centered design consultancy. And I was actually wondering if you might be able to speak a little bit to the issue of class as it relates to the evolution of transportation. Usually what ends up happening is everybody loves a great transportation system until suddenly it's in their backyard and they have $1 million house and they don't want anything to really change back there. And I'm curious, how do we navigate the issue of financial influence as we're sort of going into this new phase of our politics and our society?
Yeah, that's one of the, frankly, that's an age-old challenge. And it's not just one of the U.S. I mean, I go across the world and I see the same thing happening in virtually every part of the world. So I don't think it's an issue that anybody's really figured out, but let me try. I think what I was just saying about public input and using more of a an outward inviting kind of public input rather than a closed come to me kind of public input is really important. I think we also have to arm people with the tools to engage, because many communities don't feel as empowered to engage. The community where I'm from, a largely African-American community in the northwest side of the city of Charlotte, every time the transportation department came to them, it was always something bad. And so when folks come today, folks are sitting there thinking, like, what are you going to do to me now? And so we have to be conscious of that and to to help people get more comfortable with interfacing with us. And that's one of the reasons why we've actually built a toolkit, a community toolkit, to actually give citizens, regular people, the entire process of getting a project done, where they can engage, what language people are using, so that we kind of demystify it. So that's the public input side. I think the other thing is we've got to pay careful attention to who we elect. When you elect a governor, you're electing the chief transportation official of your state, usually. And where that person's mindset is plays a lot of the role in terms of what happens. Who's on the transportation boards and making sure that there's adequate representation there and that those voices are at the table is also critical. And that also goes down to the MPOs and down to the local governing bodies as well. So, you know, who's representing you is also part of it too. But largely, I think we're a ground-up system. And if there is low public input, not enough discussion, we're going to get projects that repeat that history. And at the department, I think our tools like Title VI and NEPA need to continue to be robustly applied. I'll say this, you know, and with Title VI, as I look back, I think there is a fair amount of, I'm not sure that over the last 50 years we've thought about Title VI as broadly as I think the writers of Title VI meant it. And for example, can a decision to not do a project be a violation of Title VI? You know, a decision not to hire somebody based on some immutable characteristic can be a Title VII violation. But can a Title VI violation apply to a decision not to do something? In so many cases, there were decisions not to do things. And I happen to believe that that can give rise to a Title VI violation under certain circumstances. And so we need to be thinking constantly in our agency about how to promote fairness and to ensure that we're doing the best job we can across the board to build the system our country needs.
So in closing, I want to say that I don't know what you have planned after January 20th, but I think I can speak on behalf of everyone here that we hope you stay in public service.
Thank you.
Your thoughtfulness and passion and common sense approach is what we need, and we hope to see you here on the Brookings stage sometime in the future.
Thank
Please you. Join me in thanking
you. Thank you.